And now I'd like to introduce our main speaker for the evening, Terry from San Diego. Yay!
My name is Terry. I'm an alcoholic. And so are most of you, so there. First of all, congratulations to the one birthday. Connie, thank you for sharing your birthday with us tonight. And to you newcomers, thank you for coming. In fact, thank you. And every time I see newcomers in a meeting, especially this size, I feel like I want to just throw a party. So thanks for being here. What I would say to you newcomers is what I heard when I was new, and that is to listen and look for the similarities rather than the differences. There's a ton of differences. You know, some of us were in jail, some weren't. Some drank young, some drank old, some got sober young, some got sober old. There's a lot of differences. And what I'm really grateful I heard that over and over, look for the similarities, because I believe inside here, we're unbelievably similar. We are very similar within. And it's that ism and it's that alcoholism that brings us together in this room tonight. It's why I'm here. The other thing is that for me, the topic at a meeting like this is always alcoholism and recovery from it in the fellowship and program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the topic. And by the way, Linda, great job on 10 minutes. You said everything. There's no more to say. You said it all. Thanks. Good job. Exactly. Thank you. You know, I would actually love to sit down right now. The fact is, I was just sitting there thinking, you know, I come here every Saturday night when I'm not out of town. I come here every Saturday night, and I'm thinking over there, you know, it's a lot more fun to sit out there and critically judge the speaker than it is to come up here and stand up here. It's way more fun to be out there judging the heck out of the speaker. And next Saturday night, I look forward to doing that again. So yeah, have at it. Judge and all you want. And I'm even open to critique later on. Say, tell me what I left out, what I said wrong, and where I, you know, tell me the bad news. That's the beauty of the deal here. You know, when I was growing up, I never thought about that I would be here. It never occurred to me that I would end up in some place like this, because I didn't drink till I was actually out of high school. And so when I was a kid, when I saw adults drink, I just thought they were crazy or they just lost it a little bit. It made no sense to me, and I made plans to never be like them and never look like them, and it looked a little nutty to me, so I was going to avoid that. And I did avoid that all the way through high school. I got out of high school, was out of high school a few months, and a few things happened in a hurry. And one thing led to another, and I had my first drink. And for me, it was instant love affair. It was instant solution. I mean instant. It wasn't anything like I had to get used to the taste. It wasn't any of that. It was like it didn't taste a lot that good, but I loved the effect. I mean, I loved the immediate effect, and I didn't know the words then. I have the words now. It was solution. It solved some things. And one of the things I didn't know it was solving was fear. You know, I didn't know how fear-based I am, and I think that's part of the ism. I mean, I don't know about you. Is anybody else in here, like, can relate to being fear-based? I mean, yeah, good, thank you. So I drink that stuff, and I go from this, you know, guy that's afraid to James Bond overnight. You know? And that's a good thing to do. I mean, what guy doesn't want to be James Bond? I mean, that's excellent. And so the fear goes away, the sweaty palms go away, and I get to operate at a whole different level. And So it was a solution. Now, there's some glitches when you're learning how to drink. I mean, at least for me, I'll try to keep this in my own. One of the things we attempt to do here for the newcomers, we attempt to tell our story, what we were like, what happened, and what it's like, what we are like now. That's what I'll attempt to do. I can't tell your story, even though I'd love to and I could try. And I know some of you, but I'll try to tell mine. And the deal you know, I would drink this stuff, and there would be a glitch, and there would be a learning curve. Like, I'd wake up with just an incredible hangover, just sicker than heck. And what I've come to learn is some normal people will say, you know, that didn't work out too well. I'm not doing that again. None of you did that, though. Oh, I'm telling your story. See how easy that is? I didn't do that. I woke up feeling like crap, and I survive a day or two, and I try it again. And I go, you know what? That didn't go so well at the end, but it's going to go better this time. Let's try it again. And I would try something else. I would try different alcohol, or I would just try something that little slightly different. And I would end up doing things I didn't actually totally mean to do or want to do. And I'd say things I didn't fully mean to say. And I'd end up in places I really probably didn't want to actually end up. But I love the effect. I love how I felt. And it was always like I'd overshoot the mark. I'd start drinking and I'd come up to this place where it was perfect. And then I'd go right on by it and I'd sail right on into another time zone. And wake up and I remember one of the hangover deals, and I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on that because I actually believe we are all in this room experts on what we were like. You don't need to hear a lot about that from me. You got your own what you were like, you know. And I remember this one day I had had this vodka experience the night before, and I remember I call in sick and I spend the entire day in the bathroom on my knees, and it wasn't about praying, and I couldn't catch my breath. I spent the whole day trying not to suffocate, you know. And I was throwing up, and I didn't have any more to throw up anymore, and it was really a bad day, And there were moments when I even wondered if I was going to survive it even. It was one of those kind of days. And I go, this is it. Okay, that's it. I evidently, this is not the way to go. I can't survive drinking like this. You know, two nights later, I'm thinking, I wonder if tequila would do that. You know. And I've come to believe that non-alcoholics don't think this way. You know, non-alcoholics just go, I don't need to do that. I don't need to feel like that anymore. I'm just kind of done with that. But what I do as an alcoholic is I sit back and go, okay, that didn't work out quite as well as I'd like, but it was good for a while. So we're going to tweak the skill a little bit here and get a little bit better at this. And so I began to work on the skill of drinking alcohol. And, you know, every now and then I'd get snake bit by it. But I got better at it. You know, I got little, you know, I'd figure out what was really a for sure deadly experience and try to avoid it. And you know, there's a skill involved in that. Still ended up doing things I didn't want to do, saying things I don't want to say, being in a place I don't want to be. But the overall effect was positive. And in fact, it got to a point where I couldn't imagine ever not drinking. There would never come a day when I wouldn't drink. It didn't. I mean, why would that day come? You know, this was the solution. This was the fix. This solved a lot of issues. This is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. To the newcomers, you're going to hear speakers at times say things like, "I drank alcohol and I did some outside issues." And when they say outside issues, they're referring to drugs. Just to decode that right now. Just to get that over with. And I'm not going to really talk about that because the reality is that, you know, I did drugs alcoholically. I did stuff. Whatever I did it alcoholically. But my drug of choice is alcohol. That was my primary and favorite place to go. There was a couple of convenient things about alcohol. First of all, it's legal as long as you're not driving or... you know, there's operating machinery, flying airplanes. There's a few things about it that they hate, but mostly alcohol's legal. And I could somewhat control it over some of those other things that when you threw them in your body, you just were along for the ride until it wore off. And I couldn't control that enough. So I really gravitated towards alcohol, and that was really my favorite thing to do. However, if I was drunk enough, I'd do anything else you had to offer, too. If you laid it out there, let's do that as well. But alcohol was it. And, you know, I ended up drinking for a total of 20 years, almost to the month. And it was like an even 2 decades. And the first decade, I didn't notice any side effects. I mean, I had hangovers. I'd recover from them. I'd have, you know, say stupid stuff and whatever, all the typical stuff. But it wasn't enough to even consider not drinking, not even consider. But in the second half of those 20 years, I began to wonder if alcohol was causing a little bit more problem than it was worth. I'm still drinking it, but I'm starting to wonder, like, I wonder if this is really, you know, it started off where the payoff was like this and the price tag's like this. And then over time, it seems like it was diminishing returns. The price tag, I mean, that payout begins to shrink and shrink and shrink, and the price tag begins to go up and up and up. And I'm not talking necessarily just financial. I'm not talking financial price tag. Yeah, and you know what I mean. I'm talking about a soul-robbing price tag. But I didn't know that then at the time, and so I began to question it. And I remember I have a friend that I was out drinking with, and I have some good friends in this room that we drank together, and we're sitting in this room tonight sober together. And that's really a blessing. That's an amazing story. But so there's one of the guys in the room, we were out drinking, and he was driving. He got a DUI. Well, I was a passenger, and he got a DUI, so he got taken to jail, and I had to walk home from there. And the next night he came over, we were talking, and then he's had to go to these drug and alcohol classes about driving. And he goes, you know, I think we're all alcoholics, talking about our social circle. And I go, you know, I don't think we're alcoholics. I mean, in my mind, alcoholics like Skid Row laying face down downtown. We have like maybe alcoholic tendencies. But fully not alcoholic, you know. And so we agreed to not drink for 3 months. I could stand, you know, a little bit of rest from alcohol, let my body dry out. So we went like 3 months and didn't drink. And then one day one of us said, hey, I'm drinking. And the other one said, yeah, me too. I mean, it was simple as that. It was simple as that. But starting then, in that second half of those 20 years, I began to have these periods of dryness. I wouldn't call them sobriety. I would call it periods of white-knuckle dryness, not sobriety. And what would happen is I would just hang on and not drink no matter what. Now, I don't recommend that. That's why I go crazy when I hear people say that up here. Don't drink no matter what. I'm actually an alcoholic. Alcoholics drink no matter what. I drank every time no matter what. No matter what I was trying to do, I'd drink again. So I'd white-knuckle for... One time I remember I was challenged by a girlfriend at the time. She goes, I think you're like a miniature alcoholic. You know? we're all afraid to say, I'm an alcoholic! Everybody's afraid to say that. I was. So, and she was afraid to own that about me and even be with an alcoholic. So she goes, I wonder if you could go a month without drinking. Well, fortunately, it was January 31st, and so the shortest month of the year was approaching. So I go, yeah, 28 days, I bet I could go a month without drinking. Absolutely. So I do. I white knuckle it. I just bear down, and I don't drink for 28 days. And on March 1st, I loaded the refrigerator with beer, and I celebrated the fact that I didn't drink for 28 days. And I drank, and I was sick on Tuesday, on March 2nd. But the way my alcoholic sick brain thinks is, I just went a month without drinking. Clearly, I don't have an alcohol issue, and I'm drunk the next day. You know, because in my mind, I'm thinking, well, if I was an alcoholic, I couldn't stop drinking. And I did it a lot of times. I'd go like a week, a month, and even one time I went 5 months. I made it 5 months. And my brain says, you just went 5 months without drinking. An alcoholic can't go 5 months without drinking. Therefore, you're not alcoholic. Therefore, let's have a drink. And it's up here. It just like goes nuts. And sure enough, I remember one night sitting on the couch thinking I'm a non-drinker now. This is all prior to AA. This is all prior to surrender, all prior to asking for help, all prior to any kind of information about not drinking. This is Terry's strategy to not drink. This is my own personal strategy. And it always resulted in another drink. Always. But I remember one night I hadn't drank in a few months, and I'm sitting on the couch, and I go, I could have a couple beers. So I'm drinking a few beers, and I remember thinking, this shit doesn't work. I'm glad I don't do it anymore. As I'm doing it. I mean, it's like, it got really paradoxical. Like, I don't drink anymore. Well, what's that? Oh, well, I mean, you know, that's not exactly, I'm not exactly drinking, you know. And there was this little era back there, a really short era, where I was attempting the sport of skydiving. And I was driving to the drop zone on a Saturday morning really early, and I had an ice chest of beer on my passenger seat. And on the back seat, and I picked up a hitchhiker, and he gets in, and I had a beer in between my legs at 7:30 in the morning, and we're driving down, and I'm taking him, I go, where are you going? Oh, the next off ramp. Yeah, sure. And I go, do you like a beer? And he goes, I never drink in the morning. And I go, Either do I. Except for now. I go, I'm a little nervous. I'm going to do something that's a little crazy. I'm a little nervous. I have butterflies. This is medicinal. I'm just drinking this beer of medicinal juice. Yeah, whatever. You can drop me off at this corner here. I mean, it's fun now. But that alcoholism, I mean, I love that line. I mean, you know how you can tell when we're lying? You know, notice that our lips are moving and we're lying. And one thing led to another, and I had a day that, you know, there's this, it's amazing. I would look at that weekend now. I mean, at the time I looked at it as probably the worst weekend of my life. Absolutely. And now I would look at it as the worst and the best simultaneously. It's the worst and the best, both. And here's what it is. I had this tradition. I lived with this woman who had a little daughter from age 3 to 7, and I had this tradition of taking her to the Mother Goose Parade in El Cajon, which is every November. In fact, it's about 3 weeks from now. And I'd taken her there every year, and I'd taken my brother's daughter there every year as well. They're both 6 and 7, and so I had made it about 6 weeks without any alcohol in my system at this point in time. This is the fall of 1991. And I'd made it about 6 weeks, and I was feeling pretty good physically. But I wasn't feeling good in any other level. You know, I was pretty emptied out and pretty destroyed at every other level. But physically, I was feeling awfully good, but not having alcohol flowing through my system and what that does. And I was about 20 years of drinking right then, November of 91. And so I pick up these... Oh, well, here's what happened. So I pick up these two little girls on a Saturday. This parade's on a Sunday morning. I pick up these two little girls, and I bring them back home and stick them in a bedroom, and they're playing, and it gets to be late on a Saturday night, and I decide, you know, I haven't had a beer in about 6 weeks. A couple beers, just a couple beers wouldn't be bad at all. Two beers, you know. Yeah, this time I'll have two. I'll just hold it, I'll limit it to two. Anybody relate to... So I have one, and then I have two, and then the guy that has those two beers in him wants his two. So now I have, he goes out and gets his two, and next thing you know, I have 4 and 6 and 8. And, you know, and then the obsession kicks in, and I'm off and rolling, and it made sense. I mean, okay, one more, just one more. And, you know, one more turned into be like, I don't know, 24 and a few shots of tequila. And then I was ready for bed, you know. So I pass out, and I wake up the next day with this raging hangover, partly because I wasn't in championship drinking form anymore. You know, I had not drank for 6 weeks, you know. Tried drinking after not drinking for 6 weeks. It's not easy. It's, in fact, easier to stay in, you know, kind of consistently drunk. And so I was hungover, really sick. What I wanted to do was take the girls home and call it a day. I don't want to go to the parade at all. But I also, part of the alcoholism that I've learned since those days is that I get to be I get to wrestle with this massive, large ego. This huge ego that doesn't want to ask for help, that doesn't want to show who I am, and really doesn't want to look bad. So rather than look bad, I take the two girls to the parade. And we get down there, and it's like, you know, we're sitting on parade on the curb in El Cajon, and it's November 1991, and it's like, it felt like it was 125 degrees. I don't know if it ever gets that hot out there. It was really hot. And I was sick, and I was just really in bad physical shape, and I decided I needed to use the porta-potty. And so I asked, there's a bunch of mothers there with their kids, and I asked them, would you watch these two little girls while I'll be back? And so I basically do, and I leave, and I don't know if I'd do that now. It seems a little reckless, but at the time, it was all I could do. And so I leave the two girls, and I find the porta-potty, and there's a line to get in it. And I'm sitting out there just dying, waiting to get in there, because I've got everything going on bad, like runs and heaves and all that stuff. And so I'm waiting to get in line, and I notice these teenagers, they're playing pranks on the guys in the porta-potty. When they go in, they're sliding a bolt in the lock, and they're locking them in. They think it's funny. And I thought it was... you know, kind of stupid, but I just wanted to get in there, not really paying attention. And so I go in there, and it was, you know, it was rough. And then when I try to push on the door, they block the door. Now, that makes no sense in a way, but man, being, now that I look, you know, once I look back at it, I'm thinking, God, what was I thinking? It was just like, it's alcoholism in 3D. It's like, that looks crazy. Oh, yeah, and then right in, you know. So, so I'm pushing on the door, and I can't get out, and all of a sudden, I just like erupt, like this volcano just explodes, and I practically break the door off of the porta potty and come out, and I go into the crowd looking for those teenagers. And there might have been a little spiritual intervention right then, because I didn't find them. I didn't find them. Had I found them, then this meeting would be an H&I meeting, and you'd be and you'd be visiting me. So I didn't find them. I had just exploded, and I came to, you know, through the 12 steps, I came to learn later that I was exploding not solely at the incident of being locked in a porta potty and my worst hangover of my entire life, but I was exploding for decades of stuff that gets inventoried and washed out in a 12-step process. I was like getting even. If I had found those kids, I would have got even for a lot more than that day. And it wouldn't have been about them. So I get back to the girls, and the parade finishes, and I drop them off at their respective mothers' houses, and I go home. And I'm on my way home, and I'm like, just the words later are in this book. I came to read them later. In pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. That's what I felt. I was pitifully and incomprehensibly demoralized. And besides physically sick, I was just at the bottom. I was done. I was 38 years old. I was done. And I went to a payphone. Remember those? Before cells. And I went to a payphone and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I had a friend that I had drank with that was actually roaming these rooms for about 2 years. And he was a little too excited about being sober. Like, he'd come over to my house and be all giddy and clapping and cheery. You want to go to an AA meeting? I go, why? Are you out of your mind? You're just a little too happy. You know, and and I, you know, so I was cheering him to go to AA. He needed to go to AA. Good for him. Yeah, it was a great place for him to go. But I didn't, you know, I couldn't see me there. And so I called AA. I didn't call my friend. You know, that ego's still large and not going to let me talk to him. But I am going to call my friend. And I'm not going to call my friend. I'm going to call AA Central. So I call him. I go down there on a Sunday, and there's this long timer in there, and if you remember, those who've been around a long time, the literature used to be right there where the phone desks are. And I walk in there, and he goes, "Can I help you?" And I go, "Yeah, I'd like to pick up some literature. I need to know. I just need a little literature to know what you guys are about." And he goes, "Well, okay. So there's some books over here." And I walk over, and there's a big book and a 12 and 12. So I'm looking at him, and I slide out the 12 and 12. And he goes, "I recommend this book." He grabs that big blue big book. He goes, "I think you should get this." And I go, "No, this 12 and 12, this is really all I'm going to need. It's a lot thinner. I don't plan on reading that big one. I might be able to read this thinner one." And he goes, "Okay." Yeah. So I buy the 12 and 12. I've come to believe, see, of all books. So I go home and I open it up, and it says, you know, I look at that first step, it says, "We admit we're powerless over alcohol, our life's unmanageable." And I'm instantly confused. Like, we admit we are powerless over alcohol. How's that going to be of any help? I mean, I'm sitting here wrestling with alcohol, trying not to drink. I'm under the illusion that we need to be powerful. And this thing says we're actually powerless. How's that of any help? So I wrestled for a week with this dilemma of, this stuff doesn't make any sense at all. And yet, you know, here's the weirdest thing about the message, the way this message comes in the darndest places. I had a brother who had experienced AA for a short time and then gone right back to drinking and using for years. And during one of those sprees where I was white knuckling, where I was not drinking no matter what, during one of those times, he came over and he brought a six pack. He goes, "Hey," or his case. He goes, "Hey, you want a beer?" And I go, "No, I'm not drinking." He goes, "You're not drinking?" I go, "No, I'm not. I think I'm done." He goes, "You're done? I think I'm done." He goes, "Well, did you do anything? Are you doing anything to be done? Like, what kind of action are you taking?" I go, "Nothing. No action. I'm just deciding to not drink anymore." He goes, "Well, you'll drink for sure." I'm like,
Who are you? What are you saying? I just you're not believing me. I told you I'm not drinking anymore.
Yeah, you'll be drunk. Trust me, you'll be drunk again.
I was pissed. I'm like, he's not paying attention. He's not listening. I mean, and then, of course, a few days later when I was drinking, I'm thinking about, you know what, he's right. I'm drinking. You know?
So on that day when I made that call to Alcoholics Anonymous, it was like sheer desperation. I had been brought to a point where for all those times, AA and asking for help in particular was a step down. And I'd gotten to a place with them. You know, I wasn't in prison. You know, it wasn't the end of the world, but I had gotten to a point where AA was now a step up. That's what it took. It was a step up, which was a bad for me. That was unbelievable. So for a week I wrestled. I didn't go to a meeting yet, but for a week I wrestled with this 12 and 12, and I'm reading it. It makes no sense. We're powerless over alcohol. What the hell do you mean by that? How is that of any help at all? So I managed to white knuckle about a week, and then I knew I was going to drink again. And something told me, based on my, based on the friend that I had that had gotten sober and been sober about 2 years, based on my brother who had done a drive-by and had some information, and he delivered that information, based on just a little bit of data, I was convinced I'll be drinking again. I always have. I will again. Left to my own devices, I will pick up a drink. There's just no doubt about it. So I called AA one more time and I go, okay, I want to go to one of those meetings. And that was a huge call for me. And so he gave me a Monday night meeting. And then I called my friend that was in AA for 2 years and I tell him, I'm going to a meeting tonight. And he got all excited. He's like throwing a party. And I'm like, shut up. This is a bad day. And he goes, oh, no, you'll listen. Yeah. I'm like, he's celebrating my demise. What? Why is he so happy? So he met me, and we met at a Denny's, and he goes, and we're about getting ready to walk into my first meeting, and he goes, so Terry, let me ask you something. Are you willing to go to any length? And I go, define any. I mean, any? What does that mean? And he goes, well, you might want to consider that, and you might want to consider putting as much effort into your sobriety as you put into your drinking. Well, that's a lot of effort. So, holy cow. They're not talking about just not drinking, I think. And so I walk into the meeting, and I sit down, and, you know, I'm obviously scared and nervous, and probably shame-based, and a lot of things running around, and I'm sitting there, and you know, they ask for newcomers. Is anybody in new? And newcomers start standing up. They start introducing themselves as alcoholics, and so, yeah, I could do that. So I am. So I stand up, I introduce myself as alcoholic, and then they do birthdays, and I witness a guy get 2 years, and I'm watching intently, like, are you kidding me? You haven't had a drink in 2 years? I mean, and that was a shock to me. And then I witnessed a man get a cake for 9 years. And now I was stunned, because not only was 9 years like an eternity, but why was he still coming to the darn meeting? I don't get it. You've got 9 years. Go home and watch TV now. So I go up to him after the meeting. Oh, and then they call on me, of course, like we do in those meetings. Newcomer. Come up here and share. Yeah, about what? I drank and I can't stop. How about that? I don't have anything else to say. They go, that's plenty. And then one of the old timers looks at me and goes, Terry, thanks for coming here. You're keeping me sober. And I'm like, I'm keeping you sober? He goes, yeah, you remind me of how pathetic I was. You know, I'm happy to be a servant. Whatever. So that man that took 9 years, I got to know him really well, and I still know him. You know, I still know him coming up on closing in on 17 years later. And I talked to him after the meeting, and I go, "You just took a cake for 9 years. I mean, when do you get good? When do you good where you know you got it now? You go home." And he goes, I don't know if you ever do. You know, he goes, picture, you know, like you take a cucumber and make it into a pickle, and you can't make it go backwards. It's always, you know, those kind of stories. It can't be unpickled. And
He goes, I'm an alcoholic. I'm likely to pick up a drink at any time. And, there was news to me, but I'll tell you what, it began to dawn on me that this is a lifelong thing that we're dealing with here. There's a story in here that has always intrigued me, and recently it's been intriguing me a lot again. And because I'll go in spurts, like I'll read this book, and I went through the steps one at a time. And the first time I went through the steps, I would have to say I did the best I could at the time, and it was fabulous, and it was rather feeble as well. And it took a few more times, and it took a few more years to really kind of come to grips with what was occurring and how much this was going to actually require. There's this stuff in here that, there's this one story in here that a lot of you guys know about, if I can find it, that sums up the alcoholism. I mean, the ism, you know, it's not about, what blew me away to find out that it's not about quantity or frequency. I could have swore that alcoholism had something to do with how much or how often I drank. But I read the book and it says, yeah, you can't stop drinking. It's more about not being able to stop than it is about how much or how often. It's the inability to stop that was really getting to me. And this is the part, this part of the book that I love. It's, this guy says, I came home from work on a Tuesday morning. I remember I felt irritated. I felt irritated that I had to be a salesman for a concern I once owned. I had a few words with the boss, but nothing serious. Then I decided to drive into the country and see one of my prospects for a car. On the way, I felt hungry, so I stopped at a roadside place where they have a bar. I had no intention of drinking. I relate to that. I have no intention of drinking. I just thought I'd get a sandwich. I also had the notion that I might find a customer for a car at this place, which was familiar because I'd been going there for years. I'd eaten there many times during the months I was sober. I sat down at the table and ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk. Still, no thought of drinking. I ordered another sandwich and decided to have another glass of milk. And then here's the famous word in this book. Suddenly, the thought crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach. I ordered a whiskey and poured it into the milk. I vaguely sensed I was not being any too smart, but I felt reassured I was taking the whiskey on a full stomach. The experiment went so well, I ordered another whiskey and poured it into more milk. It didn't bother me, so I tried another, and thus started one more journey to the asylum. And man, I relate to that story. And I relate to the word suddenly. I mean, that happens to me now. It just isn't always about drinking. It's about other insane ideas. Suddenly, the thought crossed my mind. I better call somebody and say, you know, I have an idea. I'll tell you what. And just for example, I'll share, there's a gift. A lot of gifts have come in sobriety. But one of the things that I have done is a gift, and it's alcoholic at the same time. And what it is I got challenged to do something that I had left done in my life. You know, as I go through these steps and as I do this personal work, I get challenged by what is it I need to do or accept? Because really that's all it is. It's like, I need to either accept or do, but there's no in between, you know? And so there was this one undone dream about taking a long distance walk. And I'd always wanted to do it, and I'd shined it on for like 25 years, and I got challenged to do it. And so, sure enough, you know, April of 2000, I'm standing at the trailhead of the Pacific Crest Trail in Campo. And that trail runs from Campo, the border of Mexico, to Canada. It's 2,600 miles. And my goal is to do the whole thing in 6 months. And most normal people go for a week hike, a weekend. But I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to walk from here to Canada. And, you know, it was fun to hear the feedback. I got interesting feedback like, wow, that's great, or, oh, that's nuts, or how are you going to stay sober? You know, lots of feedback. And so I set out on that hike, and I ended up making it to Ashland, Oregon. I hiked the length of California, 4 months. And I got to say, it was the most powerful 4 months I've lived on the planet. I'm grateful for that 4 months. I could have shined it on. Had I been drinking, I would have never done that thing. And there's a... One of the things about being sober is that I've become open to things I would have never been open to. And not just through the book. I mean, the book and the steps and the way we go through this thing, there's an opportunity to get opened up in hearing the message in a lot of places. And so one of the things that happened, I'll just give one story about that deal. One of the things that it still rocks my world and changed my life is I was walking with an older guy who had retired. And he'd already walked from Georgia to Maine. His wife had died, and he was a widower, and he went out and started walking. And he had walked from Georgia to Maine, and now he's walking from Mexico to Canada. And he was retired. I was walking with him for part of the hike, and the guy out-hiked us all. I mean, I mean, I'd never see him all day. I'd just get to camp with him at night. He was an animal. And we were like a thousand miles into the hike. We were in Northern California. We were 100 miles from the road. It was a cold day. It was raining. We were deep in the forest. I had blisters. I was bored. I was depressed. I mean, some of the magic had worn off on that day. Lots of the trip was magic, but every now and then it was challenging, kind of like life. And so I'm sitting under this tree with him, and I'm looking at him, and he never spoke. A real wise man, never said anything. But when he did, it was huge, just huge, and I just listened. And so I'm sitting under the tree with him, and I go, Merlin, which... Actually, I got to explain that. His name's... We all get a trail name. When you go on a long hike, if you hike over 500 miles, you're branded with the trail name. His was Merlin. Because when he stood in the forest with his white hair and his white beard and his walking stick and his pointed poncho, he looked like Merlin. And my trail name was Troublemaker, but we're not going to say that. Had nothing to do with the trail. So I looked, I'm sitting there, and it's cold, and my feet are hurting, and it's really a weird day, and I go, Merlin, this isn't fun. I'm not having any fun. This isn't fun. And he goes, Terry, this isn't fun. This is wonderful. And then he got up and walked off, and I watched him walk off into the rain, the dark forest, and I'm thinking, fun versus wonderful. And I separated the two for the first time in my life. I'm addicted to fun. But things can be, man, unbelievably wonderful and not necessarily fun, like what we're doing here. Some of the... Sometimes this is fun, and sometimes it ain't. Sometimes it's a pain. And I mean, sometimes the fear level in me and others just rises to the roof. And if you ever want to, if you ever doubt that we're not still riddled with fear, I mean, I know I am, and if you ever doubt and you want to see some fear, simply go to an AA business meeting and suggest change. Simple as that. So just change the AA business, and fear will be, you will be drowning in fear, slammed to the roof. And it's a good reminder that it's still present, it's still ever present, it's still there. So the next thing that really rocked me about going through the steps here was that this deal in here about how, and the Serenity Prayer says it all. You know, the Serenity Prayer says everything we need to know. But the fact is, it says, you know, when we do this four step, we make a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. God, it's just way easier to make an inventory of you. I mean, that's the hard wiring. But yet here it says, made it of ourselves. And then it says, admitted to God, to ourselves, to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. I mean, it's really, it's spelled out here. And then when you go down the columns, you know, you list, I'm angry at, resentful at, blah, 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 all the way down, and you move it over, affects my self-esteem, pride, ego. And that was the beginning of the end for me, because in a way that was bad news. It's like, oh God, it's about me. Oh shit. If only you had changed, I'd be fine. But the fact is that's actually good news. Because here's the good news. I can wait for you to be different, and I can wait a long, long time. And that's a long wait, waiting for them to be different. Him, her, it, whatever it is, that's a forever wait, and that's a place of victim. That's a jail. That's a self-imposed prison. The good news is that if I go through these steps, I let myself out. You know, it's not up to you. You can still stay who you are. So that was took a long time, hard to swallow, and absolute freedom in the end. Absolute freedom. In the end, it's absolute freedom. And you know what I would say too is that to the newcomers about this deal is that the fact is that I was daunted, and I found this thing daunting and overwhelming in the beginning. I'm thinking, like, the 12 steps looked a little bit horrendous. I was aghast at some of the things they were about to ask us of here. And some of the things we do in here, we come here early and set up chairs, and we stay late and we tear down chairs, and it's Saturday night, and what the heck are we doing, you know? But the reality is that they just kept saying the simple things. Just keep coming back. Just simple as that. Keep coming back. And just keep putting one foot in front of the other, and keep doing it one day at a time. And if you want to know what the days are, you know, I can count those days for a while, and I do them one day at a time. And I remember a guy came into one of our meetings one night, and after 20 years, he'd started drinking again, and he came back, and we go, "Why'd you drink? You had 20 years, why'd you drink?" And he said, "Real simple, I had too many years and not enough days." Man, I hear that. We hear that. Alcoholics hear that. We know what that means. And you can go online and you can look up on a sobriety calculator and find out how many days you've been sober. For me, it's 6,187 as of today. So, I mean, it's one day at a time. And I really got into on the hike. I'd have to say that one day at a time saved my life out there, because the first night on the hike, here we have this 2,600-mile hike in front of us. And the first night we went 4 miles and we sat out on the trail. Me and another guy did this, another AA guy. And we sat on the trail and I'm thinking, we just went 4 miles. This is a pain in the neck. This is insane. And I go, there's no way I can hike from here to Canada. And so from that moment, I was no longer hiking to Canada. The next day I got up and I go, we're going to do 15 miles. Today we're going to hike from here to there. That's it. That's all we're going to do. And I blanked out the future of the next day. And one day at a time, I made it to Aston, Oregon. And so that, it works in that level, and it works in the level of staying sober and finding a spiritual solution in these rooms. The other thing, I'm going to get out of here. The other thing I will say is this. I love the fact that they have, in step three, when they start to turn us into a spiritual direction, they have that line underlined up there that says, God as we understand Him. In other words, what that meant for me is it wasn't going to be what you were going to spoon feed me spiritually. The men that I've been involved in doing this process simply held the space for me to come up with exactly what it says there. The God and the higher power as I understand it. Not as they understand it, not as they think I should understand it, but it's clear as a bell as I understand it. And it's been a great trip. There was that during that first month of sobriety, there was three of us that used to answer phones at 8 Central, and one of them sitting in the room too. He's sitting in the room too, and we would we'd answer. There was only two desks there, but there was three of us there. And what we would do, and I don't know if this is allowed, so you'll have to check down there if you're allowed to do this. This might be against the rules, but this is what we did. Go see the guys that called us. You know, we would not only set them up like you're supposed to with the 12-step call, but then at 9 o'clock when our shift ended, we'd go to their house. And we ended up doing that about 20 times. And I'll tell you what, 20 times we did that. And sometimes it was on Mount Soledad, and sometimes it was in Skid Row. But every time we did it, it was an amazing adventure. And I was talking to one of those long-timers that's been around this thing in decades, and he goes, "Are you three guys still running around town trying to get people sober?" And I go, "Well, but it's not working. You know, we've handed out our card at the 20 times we've gone out, and not one of them, or one out of 20 came to a meeting with us. One out of 20. It doesn't seem to be really successful." And he goes, "Actually, it's 100% successful." And I go, "100%? How do you see that?" And he goes, "Well, you three jerks are still sober, aren't you?" "Oh, yeah. Yeah, we were. We are. We are." One of my favorite AA, I like to do a lot of things in AA, but one of the things I do currently is I answer phones every other Monday night with that man right there, Bob. And he's been around these rooms since 1947. And, you know, what I want the newcomers to know is that if we did a sobriety countdown right now, you'd be amazed how much time sitting in this room. There's people in this room with 10, 20, 30, 40 years of sobriety sitting amongst you. And they're waiting to help you and to show you this road. So I'm glad you're here. And come help us do this, because without you, you know, I can't do it alone. And I don't know anybody else that's been able to manage to do it alone. So come back here and help us do this. We do this together. And thanks for being here, and thanks for letting me share.